I'm David Hughes, and I'm a senior lecturer in international relations at the University of Lincoln. What got me into this particular line of research is my interest in the deep state. For more on that, you can see my recent article in Propaganda in Focus, titled Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State. I've also previously published on 9/11, and I'm fascinated by issues of black technology, and I was struck by many parallels between 9/11 and COVID-19 in terms of introducing new security paradigms, use of the shock doctrine to condition populations to accept measures that they would otherwise not accept. And there have been obvious questions to be asked about these so-called vaccines. From the very beginning, it was clear that the clinical trials, that the manufacturers weren't being honest with us. Essentially.
Well, no, they're private and they're very secretive. But look, before we get cracking, I'd just like to almost like try and undermine your entire argument before you begin, if you don't mind, and say, well, all with particularly with all these black technologies, there is a quite definite attempt by the deep state to put out, even to their own people, fake information. That is to say, almost like setting man traps for people to fall into. And so for me, you know, over the years, researching all the sort of same stuff, I mean, doing the work with the UK 9/11 Truth campaign during the mid noughties and into 2010, etc. There are all sorts of holes, rabbit holes, I suppose we could call them, that it's very easy to fall down, aren't there?
Yeah, I agree 100%. And that's all part of the perception management. It's done on purpose. It's done to distract, to decoy, to deflect, to confuse. These are all well-known tactics deployed by the intelligence agencies. And,
yeah,
and
but how do you tell the difference? How do you tell a real rabbit hole from a fake one?
Well, that's a good question. And in a sense, in my article, I'm not trying to do so. I'm not trying to claim that this or that is definitely present. I don't try to identify what these objects and structures are. The aim of the article is much more humble, much more modest, and it's to say that we have a significant number of studies that have been done mostly independently of one another in many different countries from all parts of the world, and they are converging on remarkably similar findings. So that's not to say that every image presented is necessarily authentic. Perhaps some of it is designed as a decoy. Certainly some of the imagery, for example, from Campra and La Quinta Columna and Life of the Blood, that appears to be showing this apparent nanocircuitry. I mean, I have no way of verifying this or not, but the fact is that's three different sources that have converged on something similar. And it therefore needs to be taken seriously. So
no, you're absolutely right. I mean, the paper is entitled "What is in the so-called COVID-19 inverted commas vaccines, Part One: Evidence of a Global Crime Against Humanity." So what you're doing is you're just going to try and find out what evidence there is of what might be in there. But of course, one of the major problems that the whole world has had to face here is that these, particularly these new mRNA vaccines, are patented. They're basically secret, so people are not allowed to know. You know, you're guessing and you're trusting, putting a tremendous amount of trust in the medical establishment and in the vaccine manufacturers.
Yeah, and that's a point that I make in the paper, just how closely guarded these vials are, which in and of itself is quite suspicious. And how difficult it is, in fact, to get hold of this information. One of the aims in my paper was to bring it together and make it visible to the public in a way which it wasn't previously, because a lot of it was found on, you know, for example, obscure Odyssey videos or this kind of thing. And what you often have are researchers who have independently, by one means or another, managed to acquire one or more vials. They've looked at these vials under the microscope, Some have also conducted spectroscopic analysis. And it seems in many cases they've been so horrified by what they found that they've just posted this information up online so that it is visible. Not necessarily always with the level of scientific rigor that's required. But I think that what we have now is a sufficiently large body of evidence. I discussed 26 different studies in my paper. A sufficiently large body of evidence to indicate that we've been lied to.
This is what so impressed me about the paper, is that even if it's just only one of those studies is correct, then there's something seriously wrong. So when you talk about vials, you're talking about people actually examining what is in these COVID jabs themselves, or actually in people's blood or in people's bodies once they've had them?
Well, the studies do both, and initially I was interested in what's actually in the vials, but some of the more horrifying results have come from the blood work. There's a remarkable degree of consistency between those studies which have examined the blood work of vaccinated patients, showing that the blood work is seriously degraded. Several of the studies juxtapose images of what healthy, normal red blood cells look like, and you know, generally kind of circular. They look almost kind of free floating, very natural. And the kind of red blood cells that are being found in vaccinated blood work, which are in what's called rouleau effects, which I believe is French for stacked coins, to give a kind of visual image. So instead of repelling each other, the blood cells gather together in ways that they shouldn't. And this is typically associated with some quite serious diseases. And so some of the hematologists involved have been quite shocked to see this, because you wouldn't normally expect to see it in people who outwardly often appear healthy, or perhaps only have certain minor symptoms. But this is pretty serious stuff. And other studies have looked at the white blood cells. There's a group of Australian scientists who have chosen to remain anonymous. But they show the neutrophils making a beeline for one of these strange structures, which has appeared in the blood. And when it gets to the structure and touches the structure, it appears to burst, which is quite distressing. There's another study by Robin Wakeling in New Zealand, who shows the red blood cell plasma membrane just coming apart in ways that professional colleagues of his who have spent decades looking at blood work, they've never seen before.
So, but, I mean, look, this is like a red rag to a bull, I'm afraid. You know, if you, there's a whole load of photographs and a commentary by someone that calls themselves a doctor but wants to remain anonymous, what why would they want to do that?
Oh, I think there's very good reasons. I mean, professional careers and professional reputations have been destroyed during COVID-19. Look at all of the medics and doctors whose licenses have been revoked and they're no longer allowed to practice. I mean, in Australia, the situation is particularly severe. So I entirely understand it. And I have a section early on in my paper about the kinds of attacks which, unfortunately, are to be expected on anyone who is questioning these key narratives, and it's been really quite vicious. So I totally understand why they want to remain anonymous.
If you could just tease out the main parts of the evidence that come through in this paper, and what I will do is put a copy of it up, if that's okay, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, because there's some particularly incredible photographs in here. I mean, it's difficult to tell what they are. You know what? I mean, it almost looks like a shot of some kind of spaceship in outer space, kind of wires, boxes. It looks like antennae sticking off of molecules. Maybe they're crystals. I mean, some incredible photographs in there.
The photographs really are incredible. And it's the sheer variety of objects which appear, which clearly shouldn't be there. And that there are all kinds of different things. So many studies that have looked at the contents of the vials have found what some describe as a galaxy or a snowstorm of sharp-edged components which appear to be artificial or man-made. Some of them are motile, which is to say they appear to move under their own steam underneath the microscope, and it's not clear what's causing that. Some of them appear to be some form of circuitry or motherboards or antennas. And again, Mick Anderson has done the key work on bringing out those possibilities. Some of them, the ones that I find most distressing, appear to be some form of synthetic biology. So if readers of my paper scroll down to the section by on Bärbel Gietaler, the German doctor, one of the images she provides is quite terrifying. It's hard to describe it, but it's a very frightening looking creature. I don't know if it's natural. It looks probably synthetic. I speculate that it might be a form of nanobot, which we know to exist in the last few years. I provide a link to that as well. But these are quite terrifying looking entities. And if you bear in mind that each of these images is just from a single drop of blood on a slide, I mean, there could be millions of these things in the blood.
Now, most people are not familiar with nanobots. I wouldn't even say I am familiar with what a nanobot is. Now, let me just try and guess. Is this something which is almost like a piece of synthetic DNA where it starts to self-assemble? So as it's got the ingredients of what it wishes to create around it, it's kind of doing the work of assembling something, in this case, but possibly in people's bodies.
Yes, I mean, it's possible that if there is nanotechnology, it's possible that it was already assembled in the shots. But what seems to be more likely, based on the sheer volume of these peculiar structures and the size of some of them, is that self-assembly does appear to be taking place. And many of the images that I include in my article do appear to show that. You have, for example, different components lining up in kind of a striated structure. And it's not clear what exactly is causing that, but it does appear to be unnatural. It does appear to be intentional. And some of the technology does look like possible synthetic biology. There are, for example, egg-like structures. So Shimon Janowitz, he refers to pods that actually hatch out, new structures. He talks about the kind of Russian doll analogy, structures within structures within structures. And then these egg-like structures, strange protrusions start to come from them, more kind of straight line structures, or even structures that look a bit like sperm begin to form, and they proliferate under the cover of the microscope slide. Where is all of this coming from? We were not told that such things were supposed to be in the shots. There are all manner of, for example, fibers with flayed ends. Some commentators have suggested this could be carbon nanotubes. I wouldn't know. I'm not a specialist in nanotechnology. There are also what Carrie Madej and others have referred to as microbubbles. These are kind of clearly artificial looking black circular structures that are attached to one another. And it's not clear what they're doing in the shots either. Sasha Latipova has suggested that it could be the result of inadequate quality control during the manufacturing process. We just don't know. And some of the structures are just so bizarre that words fail me. I mean, if you go to my paper, look at the section of images produced by Life of the Blood. I mean, some of it is just so peculiar. Crystalline structures with apparent kind of weed-like or root-like structures coming out of them. Have absolutely no idea what it is. But to sum up, what we're looking at here is a kind of devil's brew of ingredients. None of them should be there. Maybe some of this stuff is fake and part of perception management, as you've suggested, but certainly all of it can't be. And the fact that there is such consistency between so many of the studies is deeply troubling. And you know, one thing about all of this is the role of the regulators, because to see some of these images doesn't even require a super advanced electron microscope. Some of this could be seen using a basic optical microscope. And a German engineer, Holger Reissner, who I cite in my paper, he went on alternative TV last December, I think it was, and he did a live demonstration, and he opened a vaccine vial, examined it under the microscope, and immediately you could see that there were all kinds of structures which were much too large to be accounted for by the disclosed ingredients of the vaccines. So it's even a very basic test is enough to show that there are things in there that really shouldn't be in there. And then when you really dig into it, I mean, the images are so extraordinary. There even appear to be parasites. And again, perhaps this is just poor quality control, but they certainly shouldn't be in there. There appear to be octopus or hydra-like entities. Again, we don't know if these are natural or synthetic, if it's the Hydra vulgaris. I mean, so many questions. And again, I'm not trying to claim I know what any of this stuff actually is, but what my paper is doing is to say, look at all of this in its entirety. There is a very serious case to be made here that rigorous, high quality, adequately powered scientific studies must be done now to find out exactly what this stuff is. Because
I notice also Seema Malhotra and others have, well, many others before, but now somebody as very prominent as him. And this recent Oracle Films documentary is calling for a halt to the use of these jabs. And I mean, you've said, for example, I mean, the clincher surely is when you can see stuff going on the outside, which is mirroring these images. And you were talking about the stacking up and sticking together of the red blood cells. Well, we've seen right from the very start of the application of these, even in some of the trials, I believe, of the COVID jabs, what we've seen is a lot of talk about blood clots. This causing strokes, possibly causing damage to the heart, pericarditis and myocarditis. So, I mean, this seems to be one of the side effects which hasn't been properly examined, which is mirroring what you're talking about seeing on these photographs.
Quite right. And I mean, the work I've done here and the work that these 26 scientists and researchers and research teams have done is unnecessary in terms of making the case to call a halt to these injections. That the levels of harm that they're doing is off the scale. There are many, many studies now demonstrating this. So the fact that they've not been halted is deeply sinister, and it smacks of some kind of ulterior agenda. And when you look at what's actually contained in these vials, and when you look at the effects on the blood, you really do have to ask, what is the true purpose of these shots?
Well, yeah. And also, I noticed you have a section looking specifically at graphene oxide. I've heard a lot of talk over the last couple of years, is it 2 years? No, 18 months or so, about the presence of graphene oxide. Do you think there is graphene oxide? Is there some evidence of that? And if so, is that significant? In what way?
Short answer, I don't know. As I say, I'm not making any hard claims about what is or isn't there. But some of these scientists have conducted spectroscopic analysis of the contents of the jabs, and they claim that the result is consistent with the presence of graphene oxide. And I have read up numerous studies going back, particularly over the last decade, looking at the use of graphene within the body. For example, the EU graphene flagship has thrown a huge amount of money at this. There's I think it's called the InBrain project, trying to create kind of artificial neural networks using graphene. From what I can tell, there's been no adequate safety tests on all of this. From what I can tell, graphene is profoundly harmful within the body. But nevertheless, for some reason, there seems to have been huge amounts of research money thrown at using graphene or graphene oxide within the body. Again, you have to ask why. Now, the answers that are officially given are all very positive, that it may help, for example, to be able to deal with Parkinson's disease and this kind of thing. It may be able to help with cancers and so on. But it could also be dual-use technology. It sounds preposterous at first, but when you look at the kind of work that Mick Anderson has done around creating artificial nanosystems within the body, which could potentially link to external networks, then it becomes quite horrifying what the potential of this could be.
The transhumanists are absolutely obsessed with this idea of the human digital interface. People like Elon Musk, etc. You know, this is one of their great dreams. The idea, and of course, if you were to go along to ask somebody, would you mind, please, if we stuck a microchip inside you so that your brain can talk to the internet and the internet can talk to your brain? Most people will probably refuse.
Absolutely. And this brings us back to the issue of informed consent. So what is very clear about this is that no one who has taken a COVID-19 vaccine has done so with informed consent, because no one was shown the kinds of images that are evident in my paper. And as you say, if you see these kind of things, there's no way that you would take one of these. Now, as things stand, as of September 2022, over 5.3 billion people allegedly have taken one of these. That's approximately 70% of the human race, and I think about 80% of all adults. So the lack of informed consent represents a violation of the Nuremberg Code, and this is why, in the title of my paper, I refer to a global crime against humanity. This is arguably the biggest crime that has ever been carried out.
Just here in the UK, I think it's 160,000 deaths due to COVID, at least attributed to COVID. And there is some doubt over whether, they would have died if they got a cold or a flu, if they had comorbidities, etc. I think you cite, I'm not 100% sure, in your, I think the chap's name's Ian Davis, who's talked about the pandemic as a pseudo-pandemic. So the idea really here is that a lot of hysteria was whipped up. What do you make of that argument, that the actual excuse to have a global pandemic, to label it a global pandemic, was or wasn't justified?
Well, I think the key paper to look at in this regard is by Dennis Rancourt, the Canadian retired physics professor. And he and two co-authors put out a study in 2021. It's a long study, it's about 170 or so pages, very carefully done. And it demonstrates scientifically that there never was a viral pandemic. Now, the data that he uses is from the United States, where some of the best available data is present. But he shows, for example, very high death rates in New York, as we know, but then many other parts of the United States which were simply unaffected. He points out that I think it's the world's longest land border between the US and Canada. New York isn't that far away from there. Large numbers of deaths on one side of the border. US excess mortality was way above average in 2020, but not so for Canada. So how come this deadly viral pandemic didn't cross the world's longest land border? So there's great jurisdictional heterogeneity, I think that's a term he uses, in terms of the all-cause mortality data. And this is pretty hard evidence, really, that the pandemic itself was not what we were told it is. If you read Ian Davis's book, Pseudo-Pandemic, it's very long, it's very detailed, and it contains all kinds of information about the way in which mortality data was manipulated, how death certificates, very often COVID would appear on there when really there was no case for it to do so, the use of PCR tests, etc., to create cases, all kinds of tricks and techniques used to create the appearance of something absolutely terrible, when in fact even the WHO said that the infection fatality rate is only 1%. Analysis by Professor John Ioannidis of Stanford University put the infection fatality rate much lower. When you look at the CDC website, the symptoms of COVID are almost indistinguishable from the flu. So, again, there's something very sinister going on here. And
yeah, I mean, you're painting a picture of something rather like, you know, I would say, lies told by the Nazis, for example, about Jewish world control, the lies told 9/11 about the incredible powers of Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan to dominate the world and to bring down the Twin Towers, even though CNN could find him. I remember seeing Bill Cooper talk about this back in July 2001, saying, oh, you know, CNN have found bin Laden, but the CIA can't. And really just laughing, saying what a joke it was that, you know, that the CIA were pretending they couldn't find him and then sending the CNN to do a piece on the TV to sort of big him up as the bogeyman ready for 9/11. So what's going on here? Because obviously we took you know, even if a small amount of what you're presenting in this paper is true, we're looking at a serious, I mean, it's not just a big lie. It has elements of evil in it.
I mean, you've touched on two things there where many people are hesitant to go. The key concept that you mentioned is the big lie. This was coined by Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf. For anyone who's interested, I discussed this at the start of my paper, Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State, because there are continuities here. And essentially, a big lie is a lie that is told on such a scale that the ordinary man or woman on the street just wouldn't believe it possible to lie on such a scale. And it does involve a certain element of psychological trauma as well, and shock. It's a lie on such a scale that it's almost impossible to integrate it cognitively and to come to terms with it. So, of course, we've been very heavily propagandized to believe that Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union and totalitarianism are all things of the past, and that liberal democracy and the West are all fundamentally different and nothing like that. But unfortunately, when you look objectively and impartially at the evidence, it does appear that big lies have been told, and that really is what my paper here is pointing to very strongly. And in terms of the scale of the lie, keep in mind that all governments promoted these shots, all establishment media organizations conducted a collective propaganda campaign, which was essentially military grade. There was psychological warfare against the public to try and shame and intimidate people into getting these things.
Well, look, hang on, let me just interrupt you there, because it wasn't quite the same, wasn't quite like that in places like Belarus, in places like Sweden, in many African countries. I remember seeing the other day that actually in Afghanistan, there is hardly any deaths due to COVID. Haiti, for example, had no pandemic program and yet had hardly any deaths. So there were quite a few countries, maybe on the fringes of the mainstream media, that they didn't look at, they weren't interested in for some strange reason, that did virtually nothing and had very few deaths. Particularly Sweden, as one of the, you know, advanced economies, took a very different approach to many, I mean, say, for example, UK and US.
Yeah, fair point. I take that. And essentially, I think what we're looking at is a lot of this seems to emanate from the Anglophone countries in particular, what you might call an Atlantic ruling class. So when you get places like Belarus, which are kind of, you know, not really part of that, there was about half a dozen cases, I think. John Magufuli as well in Africa, there were several African leaders who just outright refused all of this. They ended up dead. So,
Lukashenko's still alive. I mean, I remember him saying, well, actually, the IMF came along to us and said, would you like a massive great grant to do your pandemic? You know, and he refused it. I think it was something like 7-8 billion or something.
Yeah, this is it. So, I mean, yeah, so it's not kind of evenly spread all across the world. But nevertheless, you'll take my point that collectively, across many, many nations, there has been a remarkable degree of coordination and unanimity by governments, by regulators, by the media, and with the complicity of all the professions as well, to get these shots into people. And now it's starting to become very clear that they're doing a lot of harm, and that they contain a whole host of undisclosed ingredients whose purpose, in my opinion, can only be nefarious.
What's behind it? I suppose that's the obvious question. What's really going on? You know, you sometimes we like to sort of peek behind the curtain to see the Wizard of Oz and what he's up to here.
Well, at that point we get into speculation, really, more than what we can currently show with the evidence. I mean, I think that this is about a global class war. I think that 2019 was a pivotal year. There were protests erupting all across the world, really major protests in one in five countries. So clear social upheaval, clear mass discontent with the workings of global capitalism, levels of global inequality, etc. And 2019 was also the year in which the financial system started to go into crisis. There were various indicators given that we could be approaching a recession. And that was the year that BlackRock proposed the so-called going direct reset in August of that year, which was essentially recognizing that the fiat currency system is on its last legs and beginning to make proposals in the direction of the central bank digital currency, which they're trying to roll out at the moment. So I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that the so-called liberal international order since 1945, which has really served the interests of the Atlantic ruling class, is no longer fit for purpose. And as Giorgio Agamben says in his book on COVID, whether the pandemic was real or not real almost doesn't matter. What we are seeing is that the previous paradigm of control is not fit for purpose and that it has to be replaced by something else, which he rightly calls biosecurity. And this new paradigm, I think, has much in common with totalitarianism. I think we're at the thin end of the wedge. I think we're starting to see a lot of signs of kind of creeping or emergent totalitarianism. It's not full blown yet, but it's everywhere you look. You know, the midazolam, the eugenics, the transhumanism. It's not difficult to detect this, and the direction of travel, unless we stop it, is extremely dark, because we could quite literally be looking at the bio digital enslavement of the human race. I mean, as Richard D. Hall's recent video on central bank digital currencies makes very, very clear in 15 minutes, if we allow these to happen, we don't have control over our own money. And with that, we don't have control over our own lives. And in that context, we might want to ask questions about why IMF chief Kristalina Georgieva talks about vaccine policy becoming more important now than economic or monetary policy. Why would she say that? So it seems to me that there is a financial agenda here too that involves CBDC and biometric digital identities. And again, you can see how that would intersect with vaccines. But looking at some of the imagery that is coming from the contents of the vials, I fear that it may go deeper. And I fear that this might be about either genetically modifying the human race. It could be to do with gene drives. It could be to do with turning human beings into cyborgs, as per transhumanism. It has been suggested that this is about hooking human beings up to a technocratic control grid so that their bodies, their very bodies are nodes on that grid in the way that computers currently are. One scientist that I spoke with recently used the horrifying phrase, turning people into prisoners within their own bodies. All of this is on the table. All of this is possible because we don't know what's in the shots. We don't know what their purpose is. We don't know what kind of technology is being used for this. And therefore, the possibilities are endless. But whichever of these possibilities we go with, they're all bad. They're all nefarious.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, I'm just reminded a bit of Kees van der Peel's, who I spoke to recently, his book, The Pandemic of Angst, because, you know, one of the things that has been mastered here, in a way, is the use of fear to get people to think that they've got to have a jab in order to conform, to keep safe, to stay safe. And of course, people are, you know, it's quite easy to get people to do that. But of course, as soon as they start to realise, if the population starts to believe something which is almost beyond that, where, oh gosh, you know, maybe there's an attempt to control us, then there's going to be some kind of kickback of some sort, at which point, you know, you've mentioned eugenics there. I mean, this was very, very popular, wasn't it? Even in the UK and the United States, up until the rise of Adolf Hitler, then it kind of lost favour. I wonder if there's still an undercurrent of that around, where there's a small elite that actually despise the large population. I remember reading recently that Prince Charles has said we need three planet Earths because there's far too many people here, which is, it by implication means he'd rather see two thirds of the world population gone. That eugenics has kind of got almost a second coming, you know, with the transhumanists today, although they're not actually open about it. Maybe there is a modern eugenics, and that this as Zev Zelenko, the Trump's doctor who died recently, put it, the poison death shot, that's what's behind it.
That's one possibility. I don't think that the eugenics agenda ever really went away. I mean, James Corbett has done some of the best work on this down the years. Just go to the Corbett report and stick it in the search bar, eugenics, and see what comes back. Yes, I mean, originally the sterilization in California in the 1920s was the precursor for the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute and Nazi eugenics, which was funded by the Rockefellers. Of course, it all got a bad name after what the Nazis did. But nevertheless, the Rockefellers persevered with so-called population control efforts down the years. Bill Gates' grandfather, I think, was a key eugenicist back in the day. You can trace the calls for global depopulation back to the Rockefellers and Henry Kissinger and others from the early 1970s, at least. It probably goes back further. All of this is documented. We know the way that these people think. Now, the question then is, are these vaccines intended to kill and depopulate? And some think they are. I disagree. I think that even if depopulation is a long-term agenda, and there's evidence to support that, even if that's true, you can't just kill your way to victory. You know, by the time you've exterminated however millions or billions of people, the agenda becomes too obvious, and the rest of the population then turns on those responsible, you know, the proverbial 1%. I'd say it's more accurate to talk about the 10%, really, because 10% of the world's population controls 76% of the world's wealth. So I think that whatever these shots are intended to do is part of technocracy. That's the fundamental paradigm that they're trying to introduce. Everything has to be hooked up to a technocratic control grid where everything, right down to human organs within bodies, can be monitored, surveilled, and controlled. If they are able to enslave the human race in that way, then they can do whatever they like because we won't be able to stop them. So depopulation, that then becomes possible. But I think the shorter term aim is to achieve technocracy. I think capitalism was certainly the financial system that we've had since 1945. I think is pretty much finished, and new paradigms are being called for. So the question is, what will we have by 2030, the year that they keep touting? Will we have this hellish, dystopian, technocratic system in which a small number of people within the globalization have direct control over everybody else? And by direct control, as I say, not just direct control over their money, direct control over their bodies as well. Or will we have something different? And that is where it's so important to keep speaking out, keep raising awareness, and keep trying to wake people up to just how dark, how sinister these agendas are. Because we are looking at the end of human freedom if we're not careful.
You touched on this idea. It's a kind of an epic struggle, the latest surfacing of an epic struggle, which maybe the last big time that happened was back in the Second World War, with this totalitarian force trying to dominate Europe, and people like Winston Churchill saying, oh, well, you know, what we're doing is we're standing up for Christian civilization is under threat. So this epic struggle that's going on now, I mean, why is it that so few academics seem to want to speak out about this? You're a very rare type, if you don't mind me saying so. And, you know, there's very little. I mean, obviously, in my own journalistic profession, very, very few mainstream journalists talk about this. When I was applying to universities back in the late 1970s, or was it early 80s time, there's something like 3 or 4 times the number of universities that there are now, and yet almost no academics saying the sort of things you're saying, David.
Yes, well, academia, like the media, has become very deeply embedded in neoliberal corporate capitalism. Many universities are run like businesses. Money and funding dictates virtually everything. So, for example, if you want to be promoted in academia and you're on a research path, then it's imperative to acquire research funding. That's one of the criteria. Well, that then means that you have to orient your research towards what the funders want to be researched. Now, I mean, your listeners are very welcome to get in touch with me and let me know if they know of any funders that would be willing to fund the kind of research that I do, looking into deep state criminality, looking into big lies, looking into what's actually in the vaccines. I mean, these are all fundamental questions on which questions of good and evil, human freedom, all rest. But who's going to fund them? And therefore, there's a strong tendency in academia to avoid looking at such questions. And what you find actually is that there's a tremendous level of groupthink in academia when it comes to some of this. So when I put out my 9/11 paper, which presented a substantial body of evidence indicating that the official 9/11 narrative is false, the immediate reaction by the academic community was a fierce Twitter storm in which dozens of academics from all parts of the world attacked me and said, this is conspiracy theorizing of the worst kind. They were posting up GIFs with a kind of a woman holding a pair of scissors, making a kind of stabbing motion, you know, really kind of visceral responses. They were claiming that the publisher should retract it, that the editor should, you know, hang their head in shame, and all of this kind of thing. I mean, it was really quite disgusting. Tim Haywood addressed it in an excellent piece on his blog called Peer Review or Trial by Twitter. It explains the whole saga. But the interesting point there is that if those dozens of academics were right, if my article were genuinely terrible and offensive, then they have an obligation to respond to it in the appropriate manner through an academic paper explaining what the flaws are, okay, and discrediting it in that way. Now, the simple fact is, here we are 2.5 years later, and despite the initial howls of outrage, academics have had absolutely nothing to say about my paper. It lays the most serious claims regarding 9/11, and academia has just remained silent. So I find this extremely sinister, and you know, I'm not holding my breath when it comes to academia actually investigating what's in these vaccines either. I mean, consider that in North America, for example, getting injected was a condition of being allowed on campus for many universities. Now, which North American university is then going to turn around, having pursued that kind of a policy, and say, well, oh yeah, okay, let's actually explore and investigate what's in these shots that we made everybody take? It's a bad situation.
It's almost like, I mean, it reminds me a bit of Nazi Germany, where the businesses were all around the country were all encouraged to be Nazified, in other words, to have big pictures of Adolf Hitler in there, swastikas all the way down the corridors and everything. The idea being that if you can implicate everybody in some crime, then it's much more difficult for them to do anything about it. That seems to have happened here. Most amazing. Anyway, brilliant research. But look, I mean, this is dark. It's very, very difficult to. But many people just don't want to go there, David. And I noticed this is the but at the end. It's Americans are no shows for booster is an article on Politico today, where they're saying only something like 5% of the people who they would have expected to come for their booster jabs to get their COVID booster jabs have actually turned up. So maybe people, there is this almost sixth sense, or maybe some of this information is getting out to people where they're saying, well, actually, I'm just buying out of this whole thing now.
Yeah, we can't be all doom and gloom about it. Even the official data from the UK government shows that 18% of adults are unvaccinated, which might not sound like a lot, but the figure is almost certain to be higher than that because all of the official data gets massaged and manipulated. And I have heard from other sources, it's probably more like 25%. And even that, you might think, doesn't necessarily sound like a lot. But what seems clear is that whatever these vaccines are, whatever their true purpose is, they want everyone to take one. And Bill Gates said this back in April 2020, you know, we need to vaccinate the entire world. The WHO, the UN, the IMF, you know, these major global organizations have made similar pronouncements over the last 2.5 years. Now, if you have a quarter of the population that's withstood this kind of onslaught of military-grade propaganda and all of the kind of social shaming and everything else that went along with it, the pandemic of the unvaccinated and all this garbage. If a quarter of the population has stood up and said no, then that is a significant body of resistance, and it's hard to see how you can actually get that final 25% to take one of these things. Now, if you accept Matthias Desmet's suggestion that maybe something like 30% of the population is completely hypnotized and spellbound and believes everything that the television says. And then on the other hand, we have this 25% of absolutely firm resistors. What you have is a kind of mass in the middle, which can be led either way, really, could go either way. So if you look at it that way, it might be that we only need to win over maybe another 10 or 20% of the population to a more skeptical position. And these whole agendas become unenforceable because they all require our consent. They've tried to mislead us through lack of informed consent. But ultimately, it just takes enough people just to say no, and the whole thing ends. So I think that the situation is, in fact, much more finely poised than it might appear. On the other hand, I'm also convinced that the people at the top of the power pyramid who are ultimately responsible for all of this are psychopaths, that they are evil, and that they will go to any lengths to achieve their agenda. So they're by no means done with this. They're still trying to push forward the WHO pandemic treaty and so on. Bill Gates has warned repeatedly of the next pandemic. Joe Biden has told us that there will be a second pandemic. I mean, goodness knows what tricks they have up their sleeves next, but I think they will come again with this in one form or another. And one disturbing possibility is that the COVID so-called pandemic was used to condition populations psychologically so that they learn to accept certain responses, you know, putting on the masks, which incidentally were used at Guantanamo Bay as, you know, torture instruments on prisoners, you know, getting injections, accepting lockdowns, all this kind of thing. Now, as I say, COVID itself, despite what the propaganda says, even the UK government delisted it from being a high consequence infectious disease in March 2020. The thing that concerns me is what happens if they were to release some form of bioweapon, which is actually quite serious and does kill a lot more people. The kind of panic and fear that would then course through the population might then be enough to get the 75% to put enough pressure on the 25%. I don't know. I mean, these are just my fears, and hopefully it won't come to that. But I think that we're in a very finely balanced moment, and I think we're going to see some really world historical events in the coming years.
Well, we've seen attempts to enslave large parts of the population many times in the past. Sometimes it's been successful. But, I mean, we are in the information age now, and a lot of people are switched on, particularly youngsters, to a lot of this stuff. It almost seems as if they're on a hiding to nothing. Which way is it going to go, do you think?
Well, we'll win because they're trying to commit crimes against nature. They're trying to enslave billions of people. I mean, it's just not possible. In my opinion, this is the desperate acts of a ruling class that knows that it's on its knees and on its way out. You know, this is really, really desperate stuff. And so much of the way it's been carried out has been frantic. It's been urgent. It's been botched. You know, the narrative has so often just been frankly absurd. You know, anybody who isn't susceptible to the propaganda, you know, can look at it and laugh. It's so much of it is just ridiculous.
Yeah, contradictory as well. I mean, you know, this is one of the things that always worries me when, for example, they can say, well, we're going to make sure that there's nobody, for example, who's young or pregnant involved in the trials. And yet the vaccine is rolled out to young and pregnant people.
Yeah, exactly. And on it goes all the way through. And, you know, just basic things. If the vaccine works, why do I need to take one? If the vaccine doesn't work, why do I need to take one? You know, there's been no logic about
We had a brilliant, I mean, Dr. John Campbell's been quite an interesting person to follow in all of this, because he pointed out in one of his recent videos last week, I think, that you've got the boss of Pfizer, you've got the president of the United States, plus his chief medical advisor, Dr. Fauci, all continually going down with COVID even after they've been fully vaccinated. So, you know, you do scratch in and think, well, what's the point of that then?
For sure. It's ridiculous. And the evidence seems to suggest that the more shots you take, the weaker your immune system becomes. And the fourth shot in particular seems particularly dangerous from what I've read.
So where's the best place to follow your work and get hold of this paper, David?
Well, I'm deliberately not on social media. So I don't have my own website or my own blog or anything like that. So I've got an academia.edu site. You can find my papers are all on there. That's probably the best way. I've got some more stuff coming out in the near future. I've got a critique of Matthias Desmet's book. Should be out fairly soon. Got some more stuff on 9/11 coming out. So it's a busy time, but yeah, go to the academia.edu site. It's probably the best place.
Okay, David Hughes, thanks very much for joining us.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for having me on.